You canst take all ostensible precautions you dost choose for my safety, for if I have but my long knife and a swift steed, tomorrow's sun shall see me dead or once more free. I am too old a soldier to be caught again easily, and had it not been that Artemisia's soldiers came upon me at a time when grief had well nigh deprived me of my wisdom, I should not so readily have been taken by them. Well, then, said I slowly, I will see that the horse you should stride tomorrow shall fall lame before we start. There is but one led horse, with us now, that is mine own favorite steed. I value it as the apple of mine eye. I never ride it in battle that harm should come to it, yet will I see that you art mounted upon its back tomorrow. Was you my father, I could do no more for you, for this horse is fleet of foot as the fleetest horse of the desert, and if you dost ride well, and choose the time of your flight discreetly, he will be a swift horseman who overtakes you. We start an hour before dawn. Ere the light becomes bright you may make your bid for freedom. Alzulid bent his head, and taking my hand in his kissed it, in token of his deep gratitude, and then turned away overcome by his emotion. As I turned to leave Alzulid, he said, Ahensimen, son of my beloved master, if we meet not on earth again, I would fain repeat to you, beware of Artemisia. Tarry not at the court of her son. For you there may be many brilliant prospects elsewhere, even though you wilt not stretch but your hand to grasp your father's kingdom. If you wilt show this ring unto Babajul and tell him that Alzulid gave it unto you as a token, he will, for the love, which he as well as I bore to your father, help you to prospects as fair as any Prince Salem can offer to your ambition. Farewell. Your horse shall be returned safely to you if I escape, but no words can ever express my gratitude, no favors I can bestow can return this service that you hast done me. Nay, speak not of it. It is I who should speak of thanks to you. I owe you too much already, and it is but in a poor fashion I seek to repay you even a part of my debt, I replied. We then saluted each other with much emotion, and I went forth from the prisoner's tent to seek a few hours' repose. Chapter 19, Queen Artemisia. Some time before we started I rose, and under pretense of examining the horses took care to lame slightly the one Alzulid was to ride, in order to have a pretext for mounting him on my own favorite steed, leaving a soldier with the lame horse at a small village near. It was still dark when we started, and as the road lay through a mountain gorge we were obliged to ride in single file. I myself rode on ahead, leaving the prisoner to ride in the middle of the small troop of soldiers. Just as we reached the head of the pass, and the road widened out across the extensive plain, beyond which lay another deep ravine, the first streak of daylight was dawning in the east. As we emerged from the deep shadow of the hills, I had an impression that it was here my prisoner intended to make his dash for liberty, and I accordingly spurred on my horse and gave the order to advance rapidly. As we broke into a quick gallop, I saw the prisoner and his guards were skirting the edge of a small ravine, whose precipitous sides were covered thickly with brushwood. I did not think it wise to watch him, so began to converse with the soldier who rode nearest to me. All at once there was a loud shout and a sharp scuffle, and I saw two soldiers and their horses rolling down the sides of the ravine, where they were partly caught and their fall broken by the brushwood. The prisoner, who had somehow managed to free his hands, taking advantage of the surprise and contusion, wheeled his horse round and fled across the plain, where in the semi-darkness it was difficult to follow him. Of course we gave chase, but, as I well knew, my fleet horse soon carried him beyond pursuit, and the friendly veil of darkness prevented us from seeing accurately where he went. He was, moreover, well acquainted with the country, and I was not. And although I feigned the greatest anxiety to pursue him, I contrived to confuse our route still further, and after a time we had to give up the chase. I debated within myself whether I would return to the king and confess how very inefficiently I had performed the duty entrusted to me, or whether I would also make my escape. I finally decided to face the situation, and trust that the value of my former services would palliate the king's anger at my present failure. Fortune favored me at this juncture, for on reaching the palace at Pasaikhad, and before I could tell of the escape of my prisoner, I was met by an anxious messenger who had just been dispatched to hurry my return. The king had been seized with another and far worse attack of convulsions. None of those who were present could do anything, and the queen and those around feared each moment must prove the young king's last, so fearful were his struggles and convulsions. Had I lost 100 prisoners, the necessity for my skill would have excused me from blame. I at once did as I had done before, and succeeded in freeing Selim from the obsessing spirit, but it was by no means so easy a task, and my conversation with Al-Zulid enabled me to guess why. I had little doubt that the dark spirit was that of the unfortunate murdered slave. I did not at this time, however, know precisely where the secret passage was situated, nor that the king was in the very apartment out of which it opened. When at last the patient had recovered, his own anxiety that I should not again leave him was so great that he made me the most flattering offers of every kind, for while he was annoyed at the escape of Al-Zulid, he was not disposed to visit his anger upon one whose skill was so necessary to his own safety. I on my side felt almost constrained to accept his favors and remain with him, first, because neither he nor I could hold ourselves responsible for that enmity between our parents in which we had no share, and secondly, because however much I might and did recoil from any intercourse with the queen, who I had no doubt was the murderer of my innocent mother, I hardly felt that I had a right in consequence to abandon the king to the terrible fate, which I, more than any other, knew to be hanging over him. I could see that it only wanted an opportunity to enable the black spirit to obtain complete possession of him, and I felt a certain professional interest in pitting my skill and knowledge against the powers of darkness arrayed against me. I perceived that it was no longer only the one dark obsessing spirit against whose attacks upon my patient I had to guard, but that behind him there gathered a horde of evil influences, who used the dark spirit as their weapon of active attack, beings whom Artemisia herself, in the hour when she had stooped to revenge and murder, had gathered about her, and whose influence was the heritage she gave her son. To me there was a certain fierce pleasure in combating these dark beings, and beholding them retire baffled and subdued by the force of my own will. It was as though I alone defended a fortress from the assaults of many foes, and as each time I, and not they, conquered, I felt like a commander who has beaten back the enemy. Thus I had a double reason for remaining with the king. Gratitude, and a certain affection for one thus dependent upon me, were added to the desire to free him entirely from his dark and unseen foes. In the first hurry of my arrival I had not noticed the queen, although she was in her son's room, and on my taking charge of the patient she had retired to her own apartments, and now sent word that she desired an audience with me, a command which I obeyed with a mixture of curiosity and reluctance. The queen received me in her own private apartments, and as she was closely veiled I had no opportunity of seeing her face. As she signed to me to approach her, I recognized the haughty gracefulness of gesture, which had been described to me. I felt instinctively the power and determination of the woman's character. As a matter of course I bowed low to her, but I did so with a hauteur equal to her own, and the passionate anger, which welled up in my heart at the sight of her, and the thought of my poor mother's fate, made it well nigh impossible for me to control my emotions sufficiently to answer her with respect. To what she ascribed my manner I know not, but in her anxiety about her son, which was the one soft spot in her hard and proud nature, she did not pay much heed to it, but began to question me closely as to the causes of his illness and the remedies I could prescribe. I answered her cautiously and briefly, and took care to leave the matter in as much mystery as before, while I assured her that in a short time I hoped to cure her son. "If you canst do that, there is nothing you shall ask, which shall not be granted unto you. There is no height to which your ambition can aspire, which shall be too great for you to attain. My son is to me the one green spot in the desert of my life, and on him who can preserve that son for me I will bestow the equivalent of a king's ransom," said the queen in a voice of deep emotion. "Nay, Queen Artemisia, it needs not that anyone should bribe me to give my best services unto the king," answered I haughtily. "I have done, and I will do, all that lies within the skill of mortal man, yet must we ever leave the issue to higher powers. Despair not though again the fit shall seize him, for each time it shall be with less strength I trust, and the interval shall be longer between. I shall trust my son to you, said she, but in order that you shouldst not leave him even for a day, I would desire that you take up your abode within the palace. Apartments suited to your office, and to the rank that you shall hold, will be assigned to you, and you shall bring your family to dwell here, and to follow with you when a king shall remove his court elsewhere. I have given orders that all means to transport your family and your household treasures shall be at your immediate disposal, and I bid you not to delay in sending for them, since I must constrain you to remain with the king henceforth. All that you canst desire of wealth and treasure is already bestowed upon you, and you shall find that Artemisia knows how to provide as a queen should for those she desires to honor. She then drew a costly ring from her finger and placed it upon mine in token of her favor, and though my flesh crept at her touch, as though a reptile had touched me, I could not refuse the gift, and had to conceal my feelings as best I could, since I was resolved to remain with her son and fight out the battle I waged on his behalf. Chapter 20, My Vision in the Mirror. In accordance with the queen's desires, no less than my own, I went to bring Zuleika and all my possessions to the magnificent apartments in the palace, which had been assigned to me. Zuleika and her family were much gratified by the splendid litter and train of servants and soldiers who were sent to conduct her. Had she been a princess, she could not have been treated with greater honor, and while I flattered myself that all this pageant was intended as a mark of honor to myself, it was in a great degree due to the admiration which the king had conceived for my wife on the one occasion when he had seen her in the garden at Herat. Had I had the slightest suspicion that he had ever seen her, I would have died a thousand deaths rather than have allowed her to come to me, but I was ignorant of his secret passion for her, and imagined that his sole thought in sending for her was to gratify me. As for Zuleika herself, she was like one intoxicated with the grandeur of her position. She had always been ambitious, but her thoughts had never soared to a height such as this, and towards me, as the fortunate man who had raised her so high, she displayed a warmth of attachment, which for the time was in all respects real, and I was raised to the seventh heaven of bliss by her many expressions of devotion. Zuleika was, as I have already said, naturally reticent, and not given to that indulgence in gossip, which is the bane of her sex, and I had therefore, in the hours of our love and confidence, confided to her much of my history. I now took the precaution to warn her against allowing Queen Artemisia to gain any knowledge concerning myself and my antecedents from her, telling her that for many reasons it would affect me, not only injuriously, but even cause me personal danger were the queen to learn more of my life than I had chosen to tell myself. I felt that Zuleika's own affection for me, and her own self-interest, would keep her from being betrayed into placing any confidence in the queen, after my having thus warned her, and I knew that Zuleika was far too clever and too discreet to allow herself to be entrapped into telling what she desired to keep secret. I was anxious to gain more knowledge concerning the best means of keeping the king in the satisfactory state of health which he had enjoyed since my return to him, and therefore bethought me of the parchments, which I had buried in the vault in Jalaluddin's garden. The city was but a day's ride from Pasaikhad, and I therefore resolved to go and bring some of them away with me. Al-Zulid had returned my horse to me secretly by a messenger who brought word that he was in safety in a Greek city in Asia Minor, where I should find word of him at any time I desired to seek him out. I took with me a small box in which to carry back the parchments, should I be so fortunate as to find them undisturbed, and mounted on my favorite horse, I set out at a rapid pace for the city where Jalaluddin had dwelt. I reached it at nightfall, and found that the house was much as I had left it, save for the dust and decay, which had gathered there in the few years which had passed. The superstitious fears with which the magician's house was regarded, together with the mysterious disappearance of its owner, had served to preserve it from pillage, except as regarded the costly furniture and rich hangings. These had all been carried away, but the chemicals in the jars remained, and also the curiously preserved specimens of dead animals, etc., while the house itself was intact, and the secret hiding place beneath the fountain had not been discovered. The place was, indeed, avoided by everyone. As time pressed, I quickly took out those manuscripts which I saw would be of use, and closing the stone returned to the house, As I crossed the wilderness of a garden, I thought I heard stealthy steps following me, and a sound as of someone sighing. I could see nothing, however, and concluded it must have been a fancy. I entered the room where my former master had sat with me so often, and in which he had died, and having selected certain jars of chemicals, which I packed up with the manuscripts in the box I had brought, I was about to leave, when I bethought me of the magic mirror, which I usually carried about me, and curious to know how those I had left at Barsaigh were getting on during my absence, I drew it out to look into its dark surface. Surely, thought I shall see something in this room, whose whole atmosphere was saturated with our mystic studies. Surely if the dead master can return to his pupil from that dark bourne to which he was so unwillingly hurried, he will return in this room where we worked so long together. Scarcely had these thoughts passed through my mind when I saw the mist gather on the mirror's polished surface, and as it passed I saw two figures, a man in a rich dress whose back was towards me, but whose height and figure somewhat resembled my own, and a woman, whose head, when I first looked, rested upon the man's shoulder, while her arms were twined around his neck, and her whole attitude was one of clinging affection. She raised her head and looked, not at me, but at the man whom she caressed, and I saw her face was the lovely face of my wife, Zuleika, but not as I had seen it last, soft and tender, and with the innocent look of a petted child. She wore the evil smile, she gave the man beside her the alluring, tempting glance, which I had seen the first time I had ever beheld her image in the mirror in this room, and I shuddered as I saw it stamped upon her face again. Who was the man? I asked myself, as a chill suspicion gathered in my heart. Who was it? His figure was like my own. Surely the mirror showed me Zuleika as she would receive me a few hours hence. That evil smile was not hers, it was born of the evil atmosphere of this room, which tainted all I beheld in it. Zuleika could never look like that. It was a false libel on her. And yet again, who was the man? Was it myself? As if in answer to me, the man turned his head, and I saw the face was not my face, but the king's. In my furious anger, I dashed the mirror upon the ground, and stamped upon it with the iron-shod heels of my sandals, till I ground it into a thousand pieces, crying out that it was a false and lying mirror, a cheating worthless reflector of the unseen things. And as I stormed and raved in my passion, I seemed to see phantom form rise up and glide along the wall towards me, and the face as it turned to me was the face of the dead Jalal ad-Din himself. Not the face as I had known it in life, but as I had known it in death, distorted and horrible. The low, mocking, sneering laugh of the dead man fell upon my ears, and his voice seemed to hiss out to me in a fierce whisper, "Wait. Wait and see whether my mirror had lied to you. Wait till all your warm affections have turned to bitterness and gall. Till all your bright hopes lie like withered leaves around you. Till the most sacred vows to you have been broken, and your trust betrayed. And your ruined life shall cry aloud for vengeance, and in your agony you shall call upon those powers of evil, whose aid you dost now despise, for help to crush those who have wronged you, and then say whether the visions Jalal ad-Din had shown you were true or false." The phantom faded as the words died away like a faint echo, and I stood alone in the room, with the shattered fragments of the broken mirror scattered around me. Chapter 21, The Gathering of the Storm. On the afternoon of the day on which I had gone to visit the house of Jalal ad-Din, Queen Artemisia sat alone in her apartments, gazing from the windows over the city, which lay beyond the palace walls, and musing anxiously over the news of a formidable insurrection amongst her son's subjects, which had just reached her. The banished third son of Al-Jazid, accompanied by the former vizier, Babajul, and the fugitive general, Ben Al-Zulid, had entered Persia, and their standard had already been joined by many who disliked or feared Queen Artemisia and her son. Her anger against me was kindled afresh by this news, and had it not been that she believed my presence necessary to the safety of her son, she would have ordered my arrest and execution. "Surely," thought she, "we have wise men at the court of Persia whose knowledge is equal to that of this stranger. The secret power he wields is doubtless due to some magical art. Could I but discover what it is, There are plenty of learned men in Parsaigkeet who could cast this spell as successfully as Ahrin Zimran. I shall seek out this wife of his, and learn from her what are his secret habits, and from whom he had gleaned this secret power. It is said that this is the same man who, as an unknown youth, came unto a magician and dwelt with him until both mysteriously disappeared. The clothes of the magician were found lying in a little heap, as though he had cast them off, and there lay beside them naught but a little black dust. The man himself had vanished, though whether he had left the earth or but transported himself unto another place, none of his neighbors could tell. 'Tis a strange story, yet methinks there are wondrous resemblances between the description that was given me of the arts used by the vanished magician and the youth who was his pupil, and those which Ahrin Zimran doth practice. Could I then find where the master magician dwelt, I could afford to dispense with the services of his pupil Ahrin Zimran. And I would like well to humble this proud man, who treats me not as a queen, but with almost the air of an equal. He dislikes me even as I hate him. Why, then, should I and my son be under obligations to his skill?" She rose and paced to and fro like a caged tigress, as she thought of these things, and of yet another and more deadly reason she had for hating me. It was but a suspicion as yet, but each day it assumed the stronger appearance of a certainty in her own mind. There were times when she was startled by the resemblance I bore in gesture and in looks to the dead Al-Jazid. Those tricks of manner, which are often used unconsciously, and inherited from our parents, were very marked in me, and others besides the queen had noticed them. Artemisia had never believed in the story of my death as an infant, and the news of this insurrection was coupled with the statement that Ahmed, the third son of Al-Jazid, was claiming the throne by virtue of a decree signed by the king before his death, in which there was mention of the child supposed to be dead, but thought by Al-Jazid to be yet living. Nothing more definite could the queen learn as yet, but it was enough to turn her suspicions into certainty. "Oh, ye gods," cried she, passionately, "oh, ye gods! Have I so long waited for my full revenge to find it in my hands at last? Can it be that this is indeed the son of that Greek girl who stole my husband's love, and cast a blight over all my life? He doth bear a most wondrous resemblance unto the king, yet there are times when he looks at me with her eyes, and I see again the glance of half-wonder with which she regarded me ere fear filled her soul, and she fled in terror from the dagger that killed her. A thousand times have I seen her thus. She haunts me like a dim shadow, dead always, since I killed her, phantom-like, since she had no more existence, but a shadow from which I cannot free myself, a phantom I can never lay to rest. And in this her son, for of a surety he is her son, I see again her face and Al-Jazid's reflected to me. I might kill him any hour, but what is death? A momentary pang, and all is over. The victims are gone where you can stretch them no more, while you art left to eat out your heart in a slow agony through the long years of your life. I killed the Greek girl in mine angry haste. Rather should I have killed Al-Jazid and let her live on, that I might make her suffer, and taste, as I have, all the bitterness of scorn and neglect. Fate would seem to have delivered unto me her son, and fate shall help me to extract from him and from his ruined and empoisoned life the salve which can alone soothe the bitterness of my heart." She ground her teeth and shook her clenched hands above her head in her savage desire, and struck her breast in passionate anger, as she thought over the fierce agony of her slighted love, and the scornful contemptuous manner of the dead king towards her. Well indeed, would it have been for me and for mine had I paid more heed to the warning Al-Zulayk had given me, not to trust myself in Artemisia's power. Zuleik had been in the palace for a week only, and had not yet seen the queen, when a gracious message from Artemisia filled her with a conflict of emotions in which gratified vanity held the largest share. She hastily attired herself in the most gorgeous raiment she possessed, and made an attempt to decorate the apartments. She then went forth to receive her royal visitor at the entrance to them. When the queen had been conducted to the seat of honor which had hurriedly been arranged for her, Zuleik made a deep obeisance of respect, and prostrated herself at Artemisia's feet with a truly wonderful imitation of the manners of the queen's attendants that did credit to her powers of mimicry. The queen, who was all impatience to see my wife, commanded Zuleika to unveil, and as she drew aside the veil, with which in a spirit of coquetry she had concealed her features, the queen uttered an exclamation of surprise and satisfaction, for she saw that Zuleika was indeed very beautiful. Her girlish loveliness had matured into still more perfect charms since her marriage. Artemisia signed to her to seat herself at her feet and, having dismissed the attendant women, thus addressed her, "I had thought to have visited ere this the wife of one whom my son delighteth to honor, but the cares of state are many, and my time had been fully occupied. Of a truth I must commend the taste of your husband, for you, Zuleika, art lovely enough any man, were he even the king himself." She fixed her keen eyes upon Zuleika as she said this, to note whether she would betray any confusion at the mention of the king's name, but Zuleika, ostensibly to express how overwhelmed she was by the condescension of the queen, but in reality to hide a telltale blush, which mantled her cheeks for a brief moment, bowed almost to the ground, and spread out her hands in the most profound salaam before the queen. "Your highness does me too much honor," said she, as she rose up. "I am not worthy of these favors, which are showered upon me. You art doubtless a stranger to the ways of a palace, then, yet you hast the manner of those who are not altogether unacquainted with the presence of the great," said the queen in flattering tones. "Whence did you come, before you and your husband dwelt in Herat?" "Nay but, your highness, I know no city but Herat, where I lived with my uncle from a child."
"And your husband, is he from Herat also?"
"A Hinzaman had been a traveller, most gracious queen. Who can say from what place those who travel much come?"
"Truly, yet he must have been born somewhere."
"Where did his parents reside?"
"I know not. A Hinzaman is one of those who have known little of a parent's love. Even as he had spent his youth somewhere, he had learned the arts of healing and of war in some school."
"Dost you know so little of your husband as not to know these things concerning him? If so, you art a model wife to trust, a mirror of wifely discretion," said the queen, irritably. Again Zuleika prostrated herself before the queen ere she replied, "A Hinzaman had studied in so many schools, it were hard to say to which to give the honor of his success, or even to remember where they all were, since I am but an unlearned person, and know not where all the cities and countries are of which men speak."
"You may be unlearned, but you art no fool, I do well perceive, and your discretion does you honor," said Artemisia, with a show of indifference she was far from feeling. "But if you dost desire to rise in my favor, and that of the king, you and your husband would do well to trust us with the history of his past. Methinks I can do a Hinzaman service, which will discharge in part the debt of gratitude I owe him, but to do so it is needful I should learn of what country he is. Can Persia claim him as her son?"
"I have always thought he is a Persian, gracious queen, but I will surely ask him."
"Do so, only do not say the queen desired to know, for I design an honor for him, and would not leave him to know of it, till all be complete. You art one who would grace well the highest position, Zuleika, and you must ever count upon the friendship of Artemisia to raise you to it. I am glad to have seen you. You and I must see much of each other." Artemisia rose, and summoning her maids, prepared to return to her own apartments, parting from Zuleika with every mark of favor she could bestow, so that Zuleika was charmed with her royal visitor and her head was filled with 100 ambitious dreams. Scarcely had the queen left when another messenger arrived, this time from the king, bearing a most beautiful basket of roses, amidst whose fragrance there reposed a magnificent necklet of pearls, which the king begged Zuleika to accept as a mark of esteem from himself. The slave who brought it added mysteriously that Zuleika would do well to take a walk at sunset in the garden, and to visit the little summer house at the further end of the enclosure, wearing the king's present to show that also she had accepted it. The moon had risen in the evening sky, and its light silvered as with a glittering sheen the leaves and flowers around the king and Zuleika. It flooded with its soft radiance the fair garden, yet left the summer house in which they stood in deepest shadows. As the moonbeams fell upon the necklet of pearls, which lay beside them, the king took it and clasped it round Zuleika's lovely throat, while he bent down again and yet again to press passionate kisses upon her lips. And then it was that she responded to his caresses even as I beheld her in my vision in the mirror. Chapter 22. Zuleika quiets my fears. I rode homeward as though a thousand devils pursued me. The vision I had seen haunting me in spite of all my efforts to discredit it, and making me half mad in my apprehension for Zuleika's safety.